I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Dean Falk. She's a senior scholar at the School for Advanced Research. She's a paleoanthropologist, and she's the author of the new book, The Fossil Chronicles, How Two Controversial Discoveries Changed Our View of Human Evolution. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So paleoanthropologists study, among other things, skulls, bones, the insides of skulls, and every time there's a new discovery, it shakes, a major discovery, it shakes everything up. And that's part of what this book is about, is not only the discoveries themselves, but the kind of human dramas that are caused by the discoveries.
Definitely. And I call that paleopolitics.
Right.
Because for reasons that are somewhat mysterious, the field is very competitive and volatile. And so the politics can get pretty heavy duty. And that's always been the case. As long as there have been fossils related to, our early relatives, there have been heavy duty paleopolitics.
This hasn't been going on all that long because, to contextualize the study, these kinds of studies, we're talking about Darwin, evolution, and those kinds of diagrams that you see, the little hunched over ape and then standing taller and taller, and pretty soon you get to man, and it's a kind of a visual cliche that we know. And everybody's been looking for the missing link at somewhere along the way.
Yeah, exactly. And Darwin actually published about humans in 1871 after he'd published, his famous Origins, and he predicted that there would be a fossil record discovered which would show intermediaries between ape-like creatures and humans. And he was right. That then happened. And you're right, we do have the cliche of the sequence of our relatives, who are called hominids, evolving. And it's used in all kinds of things, including advertising. And it's always, or almost always, men, which is interesting.
Oh, that's funny. That's true, isn't it? Yeah, my favorite one is a shirt that has that sequence, and the last one standing up is walking a dachshund.
Uh-huh, that's very good.
But anyway, not only are there discoveries, but there are also hoaxes and forgeries, and one of them which you outline in your book was called Piltdown Man.
Yes. Piltdown was announced in London in 1912 by the British scientific establishment, the anthropologists. What it was, unbeknownst to them, was a forgery. It was a human skull or brain case which had been wetted with an orangutan jaw, and they'd been filed down and stained to look as if it was one individual and as if it were real. And then it was seated in some gravel beds at Piltdown, along with artifacts that were forgeries, and they were stained, and very ancient animal bones that weren't from there at all. The British scientific establishment was thrilled. They thought, oh, we have the oldest ancestor here. It was a British gentleman.
Right. And which is so ethnocentric and, in retrospect, so funny.
Yeah, it was. And it may well have started just as a practical joke or a hoax, but then it just got carried away. And it wasn't really debunked for four decades. It was 1953. And meanwhile, it generated all kinds of incorrect ideas about human evolution. And so it was a terrible thing to do to the scientists that believed it, and then they channeled their own research on that false belief and interfered with the reception of future discoveries. So it was not a nice practical joke.
If you were to look at that artifact now, as, a paleoanthropologist with a lot of experience in looking at these kinds of things, and you saw something that was stained and that had been filed, would it be, to your contemporary eyes, incredibly obvious that this was a fake?
I'm not so sure. I'd like to say, oh, yes, but I'm not so sure it would be, because they filed the teeth and they broke off parts of the jaw that would have told the story. So it was a good forgery.
Uh-huh.
And it fooled the best minds in paleoanthropology at that time.
So what were some of the false notions about evolution that were perpetrated by that hoax?
Okay, well, the Piltdown Committee, as they're called, thought that, the brain got big before anything else, because Piltdown had a human brain case and a human-sized brain, and there it was with an orangutan jaw. So they thought, the brain case evolved before the jaw. And the oldest, our oldest ancestor is here in England. It's not in Asia. It's not in Africa, as Charles Darwin has suggested. And so those were those ideas hung around for decades.
Meanwhile, in the early 20th century, there was a scholar-researcher named Raymond Dart, who, against his desires, was basically sent to a position in South Africa that he went to very reluctantly and then made one of the most important discoveries of the 20th century.
Yes, and what an irony, because he had been over in England working with a group that was promoting Piltdown, and I think that Dart actually believed in it for a while, and he felt very banished. They were his mentors, he was younger, and they more or less forced him to go to Johannesburg, South Africa, to head up a fledgling anatomy department at the University of Witwatersrand, now a very prominent school. And so he went there against his wishes. He felt banished. He didn't have the collections. He didn't have the library. But he, you know, he went into it with his whole heart, and he cared very much about students, and so he had them collecting fossils to build a collection, and he was building up the library, and he cleaned up the dissection room. And through incredible good luck, within 2 years, a fossil came into his possession, which is hugely important today for paleoanthropology. And he recognized that he had what some people would have called a missing link. He had something unlike anything that anyone had ever seen before. It really was intermediary between an ape and a living human. It was a small skull and an associated cast of the brain case, which is called an endocast.
Now tell us about what that is and what that means.
An endocast is a cast of the inside of a brain case, and it fills up the brain case and fossilizes, and then once the brain case disintegrates away, what you're left with is an endocast or endocranial cast that has the shape of the brain, and it picks up any of the imprints that the brain left within the brain case, including, with luck, cerebral convolutions, you know, the cerebral cortex. And in this case, he had a little natural endocast, a little face and jaw. And he realized it was something different, and so he became very industrious, and at the end of 1924, he sat with his wife's knitting needles and cleaned away the stone matrix that had encased much of this fossil, and realized, you know, this is worthy of publication in a major journal. And so he submitted a paper to the journal Nature. Took a while back then to get there.
Yeah, because it had to go by boat.
Yeah, and it was published on February 7th, 1925. And he said, I have something intermediary. It is a man ape. It is one of our relatives. It walked on two limbs. Nothing like it's ever been seen before. So I'm going to call this Australopithecus africanus. And it's now known as an Australopithecine, and there are many of them now. And he said, and furthermore, this shows Darwin was right. Our ancestors are from Africa. Well, you can imagine how his old mentors over in London who were promoting and making their careers on Piltdown felt about that, because it was the exact opposite of Piltdown. Didn't have a human-sized brain. It had a small ape-sized brain, and it didn't have an ape-like jaw like Piltdown did. Its teeth looked human-like in many respects. So it was contrary to the whole paradigm that was out there in terms of its location and how it looked. So they beat him up for years. They weren't nice to him.
We're talking to Dean Falk about the Fossil Chronicles. So they didn't like it. What was the reaction? What happened?
At first, Dart received telegrams from around the world, including some of his colleagues from London, congratulating him. But by a week after the publication in Nature, his colleagues were publishing comments disagreeing with him and saying, no, he just has an ape. This isn't a missing link. We've got the missing link over there. It's Piltdown. And then it even became a little nastier. I mean, the tone was very cutting, and Dart was tremendously hurt by this. I had the privilege of going to archives in Johannesburg when I came to Santa Fe to go to SAR to be a resident in preparation for my project. I went to South Africa and read Dart's personal materials. And it became clear then how wounded he was and how much he really thought about his fossil and what it meant. It's a treasure trove of unpublished materials there.
It's not like he was in any way careless. He was a good thinker and very careful and very conservative in the way he presented his results.
Yes, yes. He was truly an intellectual, thoughtful person, kind, humble to a fault, intensely interested in the natural world. And he did a superb job of his description, more or less. I have one little quibble, but we don't need to go there, about the brain. But that's really a PS to this whole story. And he was wounded by his colleagues rejecting his ideas in the way they did it. He even had a nervous breakdown at one point, partly because of that, we think.
The study of science is supposed to be objective, and the people who are doing it are supposed to let go of their egos in service of the greater, basically, evidence set that is presented to them, and the interpretation of that evidence is supposed to be without territoriality. And as I was reading it, I thought, you know, these people are just like the hominids they're studying.
Yeah, yeah.
They're just a bunch of territorial primates.
And you're quite right, to a huge degree, which is unfortunate. And yes, science is supposed to be all those things. You know, there's a method and it should be objective and that kind of thing. But at least in paleoanthropology, people dig themselves in.
No pun intended.
No pun intended. They have published views that are difficult to refute, you know, until we get the time machine. But people really dig into their published views and then they defend them. And so you get a lot of noise. And if you're a student trying to grapple with what's out there and all the new announcements, part of your task is to sort through that noise and try and sift out the truth. Eventually, the truth does come to the surface, but it can take a long time, as was the case with Piltdown. Eventually, Raymond Dart's discovery was vindicated. It was controversial for decades, but then they found more and more fossils like Tong. And he eventually died a very happy 95-year-old man whose ideas proved to be correct, and everyone then and everyone now accepts them. But it took a while.
Let's talk about the study of the brain from these kinds of fossils. So you had this naturally occurring endocast. You talked about in the book how if you have a cranium, you can also make an endocast using latex, mm-hmm. and what you get is basically a kind of exterior model of the brain, mm-hmm. to some extent. What do we learn from these things?
Well, the outside part of the brain, or the cerebral cortex, is where we do our conscious thinking. And with the revolution that's going on now in medical imaging, we're learning more and more about how people think and where they think and what lights up when they think. And so we're better able today than we were to take something like an endocast and to examine its surface, and depending on how much has been reproduced on the particular specimen, make some reasoned and cautious speculation about what kind of brain that was and to some degree how it functioned. And with this imaging now, you can even take the fossils themselves, put them in a CAT scanner, and image them, and then end up with what we call a virtual endocast, where you flood fill the image of the skull, and you end up with an electronic 3D model of the endocast, which you can rotate, you can slice, you can dice, and you can measure. So we now can tell brain size. We can tell brain shape in different parts of the cerebral cortex. And then you take that and you look at the neuroscientific literature that compares at a microscopic level brains of humans to brains of apes and so on. And you can work all that together, synthesize all that information, and form, you know, hypotheses about what happened during the course of evolution. So it's not as good as having the time machine and going back and actually collecting real, you know, samples, specimens, but it's the best you can do with fossils.
Now, you, Dean Falk, were involved in a whole other discovery. Let me see if I can say this correctly. Homo floresiensis?
You said it right.
And that is a fossil of a creature that is called the Hobbit.
Yes.
Tell us about that and how you got involved. You were sitting at your desk one day and got a call from National Geographic. You thought they were trying to sell you magazines.
Yeah, I almost hung up. I was sitting in my study, minding my own business at my computer, and the phone rang. And I'm on do not call list. I don't like people interrupting my dinner or whatever. And somebody said, I'd like to speak with Dean Falk. And I said, this is she. And he said, hi, my name's David Hamlin. I'm from National Geographic. And I could feel my hand getting ready to say, I'm not interested, and put the phone down. And he said, but I am not selling yellow magazines. And then he said, I've been dying to call you. I haven't been able to now for several months because what I'm about to tell you has been embargoed by Nature magazine, and the embargo just now lifted. And then he started to tell me about there are colleagues who on this island called Flores in Indonesia have discovered this little hominin. It's a new human species called Homo floresiensis, and it's an adult woman who stood, oh, a little over 3 feet tall, and she and her peers were hunting little miniature elephant-like creatures and great big giant Komodo dragons. And at some point I said to him, are you making this up? And he laughed and he said, I can assure you I'm not. I just got back from filming there. I'm calling on behalf of the discoverer because we need somebody, or they want somebody to do the brain, to do the endocast, and we want that for our film that we're planning, and so would you like to do this endocast? And I went, I don't know, I'm kind of busy. No, I didn't say that.
It was an amazing opportunity.
It was like,
to do exactly what we're talking about, these endocasts.
Yeah. And I said, yeah, I think I can work it into my schedule. And then I talked with him almost daily, and we ended up, I said, look, I can do a latex endocast from a model of this very fragile skull, but it's not going to be very good. We need a virtual endocast. We need CAT scan data. Can we get those data? And eventually it was worked out where the raw CAT scan data were sent to my colleagues with whom I did the project there at Mallinckrodt Institute of Radiology at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis. And so the data went over to Mallinckrodt, and then we started working on it. A couple of engineers did the brain, rendered the endocast, which was just gorgeous, and then we did a comparative study. And so that was how, you know, tremendous good fortune.
So in this whole story of the of this hobbit and the this whole world that these hobbit people inhabited, I mean, there's a story of the technology and the MRIs and the endocast and all that stuff, but what did it finally tell you about these tiny people?
Well, the discovery of Hobbit met with the kind of controversy that Dart's announcement of Tong had in 1925. In both cases, some of the public were upset to do with their religious beliefs. And in both cases, there were scientists who disputed the find. And that's true with Hobbit or Homo floresiensis, which surprised me because I thought, you know, it's then it was 2004 when it was announced. I thought, it's 2004. You'd think that there'd be more objectivity. But there was a small group of vociferous scientists who said, look, it's not a new human species. It's a pathological human being, somebody with a disease called microcephaly, where they're born with very small brains and heads. And so there was that to contend with. And it's calmed down some. It's still going on, but Hobbit is being relatively well-received now by scientists in a surprisingly short amount of time. The scientists then began studying all parts of the body. I got to do the brain case, but there were other people who worked on the shoulder and the elbows and the
wrist. It was
the
whole skeleton.
It was the whole skeleton. And so different specialists. I mean, there's a man at the Smithsonian named Matt Tocheri. He does wrists. And he did hobbits' wrists, which, by the way, are very ape-like. And there's a man at Stony Brook, William Jungers, who did the lower extremity. He's done wonderful work on body proportions in Hobbit and the feet. And a woman named Susan Larson at Stony Brook who did shoulders. So the skeleton got apportioned to different specialists. And they have each made their own analysis, compared it to apes, compared it to other kinds of relatives, early relatives, and interpreted the specimen. Right now, there is not a consensus on where exactly Homo floresiensis came from. We know that there are fragments of 8 or 9 individuals at least that stretch back to almost 100,000 years ago, from about 17,000 years ago.
How old is this fossil?
Hobbit is only 18,000 years old. But there are other specimens that go back to 95,000 where the fragments look just like her. Then there are tools that were found in association with her in the cave that there are tools like them on the island that go back to a little older than 1 million years ago. And it's an island that's hard to get to because of drift patterns. And so the history there is that the animals on that island, it's deep time. It hasn't been colonization after colonization. So the question is, where did Hobbit's ancestors come from, and what did they look like? And there's still a lot of discussion about that. Right now, quite a few scientists are saying, in many ways, she looks like some of the australopithecines that weren't supposed to have gotten out of Africa, you know, like Dart's discovery. Others say she's looking like the first Homo, the early little Homo that did get out of Africa. So people are looking into deep time. My team, we consider that too, and it's a reasonable hypothesis, although we haven't ruled out the possibility that the ancestor was Homo erectus, who lived just next door in Java at the right time, and that there might have been some miniaturization called island dwarfing that went on. Some other people are kind of cool to that hypothesis right now. I still hold that as, you know, it could be a combination. I suspect some dwarfing did go on. So, you know, the field's asking, you know, where'd she come from? The consensus, well, it's not a consensus, but the tide is going in the direction where there's acceptance of the legitimacy of the discovery, remarkably quickly, I think, all things considered.
It really is, I mean, one of the takeaways for me from this book is the importance of being able to say, we don't know the answer, and hold that, and keep refining the questions over a long period of time, yeah, when you really want an answer.
Yes, yes. And I think reasonable scientists do that. And also you have to be willing to change your mind if evidence comes along. And some people just aren't willing to do that.
Yeah.
So it's frustrating when you've got a small band of scientists that haven't studied the material, and they're just determined to debunk the find. And then you go to meetings, and there's yelling and screaming. And it's frustrating because it's just hard to deal with that kind of an approach. And so what you have to do is every time they put a new hypothesis out there, like it's microcephaly, you know, this disease, well then, you know, my team, we had to drop everything and study microcephaly, which we did, and we are convinced, and I think we've convinced others, no, it's not a microcephaly. Well, Laren syndrome. We dropped everything we did Laren syndrome. It most certainly didn't have Laren syndrome, et cetera, et cetera. So it takes time, but then that's the way science works, is you get hypotheses, and they have to be falsifiable.
Yeah.
It has to be something specific that you can potentially confirm or deny to be scientific.
When you have Dean Falk, we're talking to Dean Falk about the Fossil Chronicles. When you have a fossil that's that old, is there any DNA on it?
Well, it depends what part of the world you find it in. Hobbit's certainly of an age, 18,000 years, where you could get ancient DNA, but she was in this very hot habitat, which isn't good for preservation. And also, she wasn't collected in a manner that would prevent or minimize contamination from human DNA. So the efforts to extract her DNA were not successful. They are looking now for more specimens, not only on the island, but in other nearby islands. And a goal is to collect DNA that, in fact, could yield some information. What's interesting, though, is that other older hominids, such as Neanderthals, who were in very cold climates, have had their DNA extracted and sequenced and studied by people in Leipzig at the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology.
And there's a Neanderthal genome.
There is a Neanderthal genome now, which is very, very interesting. And it shows, to the surprise of the people who did the study, that in fact non-Africans today do carry a certain amount of Neanderthal DNA. There was interbreeding between Neanderthals and contemporary people that live in Europe and Asia and so on, which was a surprise. And so that means things were a little bushier in terms of number of species. Even more recently, a little pinky finger bone was found of a woman who lived in Siberia, and the same institute studied her DNA, and her kind, who were different than us and different than Neanderthals, were widely spread in Oceania and in parts of Asia. And so, and they were, the times overlap between Neanderthals, this group, and Homo sapiens. So evolution was definitely really bushy at the time.
Well, and
Hobbit.
By bushy, like, I guess what I hear you saying is non-linear. So we have this idea that there's a line, one thing follows another, follows another.
Yes.
But in fact, it's sort of people were interbreeding or beings were interbreeding in all kinds of ways.
That sequence, you referred to the sequence, the line from the ape up to the human that's used so much in advertising. Right, that's being questioned now because there was a lot more variation than was dreamt of before. And so this is another revolution that's going on right now with the ancient DNA studies, and it's just getting off the ground. It'll be very exciting. And for Homo floresiensis, what needs to be done, if at all possible, is to find them in a condition where the ancient DNA can be extracted and sequenced, and that's going to be tremendously exciting. A nail-biting time for some of us. It would be really, really interesting.
Now, you just filmed a NOVA documentary on this very subject.
Well, actually, it was more to do with brain evolution. I talked to them at SAR about the fossil record of brain evolution. And so it's for a program that will air in the fall. And it was fun. They were here 2 weeks ago, I think. And it was really an interesting time, yeah.
One of the things that I thought was so interesting in your book about the brain and about intelligence and the differences among even contemporary humans, you've got hunter-gatherers who have a kind of literacy about the natural world which makes us look like totally illiterate dummies, whereas they're not literate in quote-unquote reading or things that we might value, but they can read a landscape in a way that we can't. And I wonder, like, does that affect what the brain actually, how it grows, what it looks like?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Reading's not been around that long, you know, what, 6,000 years maybe at most. And there are very specific parts of the brain that are very active during reading. And there are parts of the brain that have always been there. And so you do wonder, what were they doing before? And it's a good guess that they were used for things like tracking animals. And you're right, anthropologists that go to non-industrialized cultures, like some hunting and gathering ones, are amazed at the tracking abilities that they have. You know, they just
can't
leave.
And the oral history.
Right, and the kinship, keeping track of all that.
Yeah, it's encyclopedic.
So different cultures use their brains in different ways. And I think that that all cultures will have a range of variation in terms of the intelligence within that population. They'll all have their geniuses. It's just that a genius in a, you know, a traditional non-industrialized culture is not going to be sitting around worrying about nuclear physics.
Dean Falk is a senior scholar at the School for Advanced Research. She's a paleoanthropologist, and she's author of the new book, The Fossil Chronicles, How Two Controversial Discoveries Changed Our View of Human Evolution.
Thank you very much.